Welcome to the Revision Path Podcast, a showcase of the world's black graphic designers, web designers, and web developers. I'm Maurice Cherry, and before we get started, I wanted to remind you about our survey again. It only takes a few minutes to complete. It'll really help shape the future of Revision Path once we get your feedback. Just go to revisionpath.com/survey to fill that out. Also, we're now available on iTunes and Stitcher. You can visit revisionpath.com/iTunes or revisionpath.com/Stitcher to subscribe. Make sure to rate us 5 stars and write us a good review as well. The more downloads, subscribers, 5-star ratings, and reviews we get, the more we can get the word out about the show. This week, I talked with the venerable Michelle Washington, a designer and educator in New York City. Here we go. Okay, so tell us who you are and what you do.
My name is Michelle Washington. I do creative direction, branding strategy, and design writing. And I live in New York City.
All right. How is the design scene in New York City?
I look at design in many different ways. I don't look at it totally from the area that I work in as a graphic designer or creative director. I look at it as a whole, whether people are doing product design, whether they're makers, whether they're doing fashion design, industrial design, textile design. So I think there is a lot going on with the creative community, or I could even say creative entrepreneurs and what they're doing. There are a lot of different areas in Manhattan that are popping up, with co-working spaces that a lot of creative people are using. The same thing is happening in Brooklyn and also in parts of the Bronx. There's some co-working spaces that are opening up. So there's a lot that's happening. And I shouldn't leave out Queens, Long Island City in particular.
Nice, nice. Now, you also come from a very artistic family. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, I can. I have two uncles that studied art in college. My mother's brother, Charles Jones, studied advertising, and that was his major at Syracuse University. He initially thought that he would graduate and work in an advertising agency, but soon after school he got married and had a kid, and he said, well, working in an ad agency wasn't paying enough to support him and his family, so he ended up going in to education, so he taught art in high school. My father's youngest brother, Horace Washington, is an artist in San Francisco. He works with handicapped and disabled kids, teaching them art, but he also is a practicing artist. He does a lot of art in public spaces throughout California and exhibits quite a bit. He has this series that he's worked on off and on for a number of years. They're masks, and they're different size masks, and they basically represent the diversity that you will see in California. California is one of those places that just has people that come from all over the world, and a lot of, I would call them first world countries, different parts of Asia, South America, Mexico, and I would also think maybe a little parts of Northwest Africa, too. So his masks sometimes are cast in bronze. They are embedded with ivory. Because I had an aunt that lived in Northwest Africa many years ago. And at the time when it was legal, she would give him pieces of ivory. So there are a couple of pieces that I know he's made that have ivory and other precious stones and those. And that's really it.
Okay, nice. Let's talk a little bit about the work that you've done with Visual Perceptions. This was a sort of like a project that you did together with Faux Wilson, is that right?
Yes, I did. Faux and I have worked together over the years, probably midway through our careers. She had a studio. She worked at Essence. I worked at Essence. I worked in her studio with Studio W. And right after she had left, Essence, she was teaching part-time at Parsons. And there was an exhibit at Parsons. And there was a I want to say it was a black face on toothpaste. Someone had done art along that line, and I can't remember who the artist was, where the art came from, but it was an exhibition that students there found disturbing, and they, a group of students challenged the school to take the artwork down. The school said there's freedom of speech of artists. The piece was defaced. It made the local news. There's a lot of back and forth in the news about the subject matter and how it would be offensive to the student body, being very insensitive to just, you know, it's a broad range of students from all over the world. So as a result, the school put out a call for anyone that wanted to do an exhibition that dealt with this sort of sensitivity of race and identity. And so since Bo was working there at the time, she asked me if I would be interested in collaborating on a particular project with her for an exhibition. And so we developed Visual Perceptions of 21 African-American Designers Challenging Modern Stereotypes. And it dealt with race and identity of how Black Americans had been in the past and were currently being depicted in the media, print, online, packaging, in every aspect, music, film. And so we put together a list of designers from all over the country. And some of the designers we didn't know, a few we did know that were local. And it was really quite successful. The exhibit traveled for 2 years. We also organized a panel around the exhibition, so different locations where the exhibit would be featured, either Foe or myself and Eric Perkins, who at that time had done a lot of extensive work on race and identity with black cartoons, packaging, advertising, old advertising. Eric had an amazing collection of all of these old black cartoons, Coontown thing, books, a lot of ephemera, things that I had never seen or even heard of way before I was even born. And so he was quite an authority on this particular topic. And that's what we did.
Now, was this before or after IGA's design journeys?
The AIGA. It was before the AIGA design journey. We actually did meet with the former director of the AIGA, and so Visual Perceptions was featured in their at their Chicago conference. AIGA has a national conference, and so from our meeting with Carolyn Hightower and Nathan Gluck, they asked us if they could host Visual Perceptions for the national conference, and it was quite successful. And they also put on a panel with Foe and Roger Tucker, and there were two people from Nike. So that was the only connection we had with them, but never a connection through the design journey. That was something totally separate. I can't remember 100% how Design Journey fully came to be, but I do remember there was, I want to say Bill Grant out of Atlanta was the president, I believe, at the time, and he had decided that there should be a major initiative in pushing forward designers of color and from different diverse backgrounds. It's not the first time that the AIGA has tried to mount a program or any type of initiatives or efforts that around designers of color. They've done it like at least two or three times here before in New York City that I remember of. But this particular time with Design Journeys was actually setting up an advisory board, and I was part of the advisory board with Steve Jones, Maurice Woods, there was Gail Anderson, Rebecca Mendez, Raphael Esca, and Bennett Pagey. I know I'm leaving out a few other people. Victor Margolin, who's a design historian, and Victor has this book that just came out last year. It's a 3-volume book on global design that takes you all over the world. And I think the interesting thing about Victor's book, if I'll speak about that for just a moment,
sure.
is that Victor has focused on countries and cities and places where you normally don't think of designers or design coming out of, and some very sort of rural parts of the world. And Victor is also, I met Victor when I lived in Chicago. And at that time, I had done a lot of research on the history of Black graphic designers from a lecture series I had developed. And Victor at that time was also interested in my research because the University of Illinois and the Chicago campus was developing an archive of collecting materials on Black designers from Chicago. And Victor had later on had started developing his own body of research. And he has a short film that he's done on the Black designers in Chicago. That's quite interesting.
Oh, what's the film called?
It's just Chicago Black Designers. If you're ever interested, I could put you in contact with Victor. And he's got people in the film that have worked in advertising, people that have been architects, industrial designers, product designers.
Yeah, sure. I would love that. I would love to see that.
Yeah, it's quite good.
So speaking about Chicago, I know that you've done art direction work for the Chicago Tribune as well as the New York Times. What was that experience like?
Well, it's really interesting working in newspapers because it's a very quick turnaround. Mm-hmm. You don't have a long time to sit and ponder over a design idea, an illustrator, or photography, or hiring a photographer. Something closes daily. When I worked at the New York Times, I worked on the arts and leisure section, travel, business, and book review. And you hired an illustrator, you give them your time frame. It's not like they would give you your sketch on Wednesday, and then the following Wednesday you could say, oh, yes, I need a final sketch. You had to tell them, okay, I need the sketch back in 24 hours, and then I need the final the next day. So there wasn't a long window of time for you to give any of the vendors or that you were working with, illustrators, photographers, a chance to do anything. There's a photo editor, so you would work with a photo editor on securing photos and making any type of photo assignments. I also worked very briefly on the magazine side with the New York Times. And then with the Chicago Tribune, we had a longer window of time, even though it was a weekly. I worked on a section called Women's News, and I also worked there doing special supplements for the magazine, Chicago Sunday Tribune Magazine, Home and Health. I have to remember these things. And so with the special supplements, I could actually work with the staff photographers on photo shoots. The Chicago Tribune very rarely hired outside photographers. Everything was done by their in-house photography team, and which was actually quite interesting because you could have someone that would normally be out one day shooting a fire, a politician, or some type of award ceremony. And then you would say, oh, yeah, you know, I really want to work with Bob because he's really good at shooting food or interiors. And then you would have that same person come in and do an interior shoot or someone else that you knew that really was very good in doing portraitures. You could say, well, I really want them to come in and shoot in this health club for me because we're doing this whole workout routine with this health fitness guru. And that's how I worked at the Chicago Tribune. It was a pretty quick turnaround there. I would say the difference was that we were on computers at the Chicago Tribune. When I worked at the New York Times, they were not fully up on computers yet, even though other publications were working on computers. So I also worked in magazines. So once computers came into the scene, everything started to change with magazines and newspapers because there was a sharing where you had to share your files with the editors. So the editors would input the corrections. You would do the design on your part. There could be some color correcting by the production department, or you get the photographers to do the color correction on the digital file. So I would say that I've straddled working, doing layouts from cut and paste with cold metal type, hot metal and cold type. I'll correct that. And switching over to working on computers. So whereas now there's a whole generation of designers that only know what it is like to work on computers.
That's interesting you mentioned that. We interviewed Emery Douglas back in January.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of what I talked about with him with design was sort of the time of designing before computers. A lot of, like you said, a lot of design now seems to be firmly attached to technology.
Yes. You know, I still do I like to sit and draw and sketch. I didn't study graphic design as an undergraduate student. I studied fine arts, mainly printmaking and painting. And so I was really very good at drawing. I had an amazing high school art teacher, Mrs. Gerard, that passed away about 2 months ago. An interesting thing, I'll regress a little bit, she had also taught my uncle, Horace Washington, also in high school.
Okay.
About 12 or 15 years before I had gotten there. And so she was very good. I mean, she really pushed students to go to college and study art. And if you took any of her art classes and you were not really skilled, she would discourage you from taking any more classes, or would just tell you, I think you should switch to another elective course because this art class is not for you, darling. She was very blunt. But I you know, learned how to sketch everything out by hand. Once I got to graduate school, I went to graduate school at Pratt for communication design. But it's interesting because initially when I went to graduate school at Pratt, I first started out in printmaking. And then I soon realized that, well, what am I going to really do with printmaking, even though I love printmaking still? That I did switch to graphic design in their graduate program because I realized I could actually make a living. And I had taken like one design, sort of, I would say, commercial art class in undergraduate school. And that was really helpful for me to get me to understand different ways of utilizing the fine arts background that I had, and then also this new area of working in with typography. And but I knew how to sketch out my concepts and ideas. But at that time, we used letterpress and a photostat machine, mm-hmm, and a copy machine and a Lucy machine. So I do understand what Emery Douglas is talking about. Whereas now, if I fast forward, I went back to school a few years ago and got a second master's in design criticism from SVA. What I look at with that is that I'm working on a laptop and a desktop for my courses, because it's all writing, research, and curating. I'm learning programs like Pro Tools to do interviews and develop podcasts, and also taught myself how to use Premiere and After Effects so I could do short video segments with another project that I've been working on with a colleague, collaborating to do short films on designers and makers of color. But we have all this technology now that allows us to do a lot more, but I still feel that skills that I learned in undergraduate and in graduate school at Pratt are just as applicable today as working on a computer. Because like I said, if I'm writing, I write out notes by hand and I create these diagrammatic concept maps, and I will type out all of my notes and just write up everything that I want to say about this particular person, or if I'm writing about a building, a piece of architect or I'm right doing something about public space. And then I might even print everything out and cut apart sections with scissors and tape them back together again and put them up on a wall. So I still use some of those hand skills, and I sketch for design. I sketch out everything. If I'm doing a logo for someone, I will sketch it out. I don't get on the computer and do my sketches. I do hand sketches. So I just feel that I can do the hand sketches much quicker than I can do sketches in Illustrator. I know that there's some younger designers or maybe seasoned designers that feel that they don't like working that way. But even in any of the courses that I have taught and what I teach now part-time at FIT in the exhibition design class, I make all the students sketch because I just feel that it explores a different part of your brain cells, and it just makes you think differently. And you're always constantly changing. So when I went back to graduate school the second time, I used some of the skills that I had as a designer to think about how I would write and do my research. And I realized that writing is about revising. And if you're designing, you're always revising your designs early on until you get something approved. And even once it's approved, things change. So you're constantly changing. And even when everything's finalized and you're going to go to the printer, you still kind of think there's this sort of little nitpicky things that you could change. And writing for me has become the same thing. So I'm constantly revising and thinking of how I could write a sentence differently or structure a paragraph differently. And so I relate those two things together, elements together, and I just look at what I've learned in the past and apply it to the present as much as possible. I don't know if Emily Douglas does the same thing, but I do love his work. I would say that in high school, I had a collection of Black Panther newspapers with all of his work in there.
Oh, wow.
And oh, yes. My mother wouldn't let me bring them in the house, so I kept them in my locker at high school. And at some point when I was halfway through college, I had to get rid of them because I had no place to store them. And they're worth it. I don't know. They've bitten the dust, I'm sure.
Now, let's talk about that the design criticism masters that you talked about that you said has to do with sort of writing and research. How can designers benefit more from design criticism?
You know, it's a program that focused on design writing, research, and curation. I think that designers, I found that a lot of my design friends write really well and like writing. And I think that, and most of these friends, they teach. And I would say part of my reason for going is that a friend encouraged me to go. And she kept saying, she said, "You should really apply to this program with Sylvia Harris. This would be perfect for you. It would really teach you how to write because you're always doing this research and you want to write books and you want to do all these other things that you keep talking to me about. And you really need to go to this program." And so I applied. And it was an amazing experience. For me, I met some really wonderful classmates and people who were in the first class. I was in the second class to graduate, and people in the first class were great. And I've made friends with people that have come after me, you know, in the program. And people sort of form this close knit of alums, and we call ourselves D-Critters. And it's really nice because we can network with each other. Some people do not come from a background in design at all. Some people come from an architecture background. Some people come from a writing background where they've worked in newspapers or magazines, but maybe they've written mainly about design or architecture. There was one person in my class that had a background in industrial design that was from India. There was someone in the first class that had worked for a major publisher. I want to say it was Chronicle, and he had worked on a lot of design books and photography books. And so he was really well skilled in the area of writing and design writing. So you know, it's nice because there's a cross section of people. But for me, when I look at it and thinking about as a design educator, I feel like students need to be able to not only verbally communicate their ideas, but to be able to communicate their ideas in writing. I teach part-time in the exhibition design program at the Fashion Institute of Technology. And for the last 3 years, I have served as a thesis advisor to some of the students. And it's really interesting that some of the students have a hard time actually articulating what they want to say in writing. And so there's a writing center, so they have to deal with the writing center, but they need to be able to write down a description of what the project is going to be so that it's clear to a stranger or someone that has no idea about what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And that can be a challenge for some students, even if English is their first language. And sometimes people can verbally communicate it, but they cannot communicate it in words. So sometimes I make a student record what they're telling me and then listen to that recording over and over again and then say, now write what it is you really want to say. And it'll take them a while to get it. And I think part of it is that you initially think that writing is very easy, but it's not. It's very hard. And to write with clarity is difficult. I can think about some of the writers that I whose work I really love. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing her first name right, but she has a book, America, out. And Follow the Yellow Sun was another book I read of hers. And Toni Morrison. They have a way of painting their words on a page. Mm-hmm. And I would say I know that they're writing over and over and over again. And not every time that you come to the page or look at your screen or start writing out by hand is everything gonna just flow. And so I think with a design student, they expect for it to flow immediately. And I also taught a year ago at Parsons in their design strategies program, a data and visualization course. And I would make the students do a writing assignment for one of the projects. And I remember explaining to the class at one point how many times I would revise an article. And one of the students said to me, "You're joking." And I said, "No." I said, "I could do it 25 times. I could do it 10 times. I said, but I keep revising until I get it right. And then I also explained to them that I read everything out loud. And sometimes I read it backwards, like tapping each word backwards just to get a sense of flow. And one of the students said, "You know, I've never thought of reading my writing out loud," because I would make them also read their writing out loud. Mm-hmm. So they could hear what everything sounded like and what the words sounded like. And that started to help several of them to clean up and revise their writing. So that's my long-winded answer about writing and design.
I want to talk a little bit about this notion of the Black aesthetic. Mm-hmm. In 2011, at the DCRIT conference, you did a talk called Untangling the Naps.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Okay. That was my thesis
topic,
and it took me a long time to get to Untangling the Naps. And I started out initially trying to do the history, not a history, but more of a focus on Black graphic designers, because I had done an extensive research on the topic of Black graphic designers of the 20th century. I had lectured extensively on it. And once I got all my ducks in order and collected all the information, I wrote up an abstract. The advisor and the chair said, "This is a lot." And we had to present all of our findings and our preliminary work to a panel of critics. And they loved the idea, but they said, "You know, you only have 10,000 words, and what you're talking about is a book." And so maybe you want to narrow this down and focus just on one area. So I really had a hard time figuring about what exactly do I really want to do. Mm-hmm. So I went in, I set up a meeting, and I went in and I sat and I talked to the chair. And we went back and forth, and she said, there must be something, just one thing, like a symbol, an icon, or something that you could just focus on. And chair is very good in getting you to really tease out your thoughts and information, Alice Twimlow. And it popped into my head. I said, the Afro. And she said, okay, that's perfect. And she said, I don't know a lot about the subject matter and topic, but what is it about, you know, the Afro that you really think about? I said, well, you know, I said, there was a lot of design that evolved out of the Afro. There was a whole body of symbols and icons. And so that's how my thesis topic emerged. And so I also had to do an applied thesis, which was a very crude film of people that I had interviewed and some ephemera that I had collected that grew out of the Afro from the 60s, 70s, and what is happening now in Black popular culture with the Afro. And through my findings and my research of interviewing people and going around, one of the things that I started to notice is that social media has become a really big platform for Black women, in particular younger Black women, to talk about their hair. So if you think about the Afro, it has a series of iterations and names from the Afro to the fro to the natural. And it's a hairstyle that has endured over time. I mean, it started back in the 50s with Abby Lincoln and Nina Simone. And now if you fast forward, there are people like Michael July that are doing books just on women with natural hair, the Afro, fro, whether it's the teeny-weeny Afro or the big bulbous Afro. And I started to think about, you know, how the Afro has transcended over time. And it's used today in social media where women actually openly and freely talk about their hair, how they care for their hair, products they use, products they make. Black women never really talk openly, publicly about hair in its natural state. It just wasn't something you publicly talked about. Mm-hmm. And but now you go online, you can find blogs about natural hair. You can find people on Twitter, women on Twitter talking about natural hair. You can find it on Facebook. I'm not sure about Google+, but I'm sure that, you know, somebody must be there. YouTube. There's some two sisters that I watch their videos on YouTube. They have a whole YouTube channel that's devoted to Black hair care for the Afro, products that you can use, the products that you can make, you know, hairstyles. And I was just like really astounded, and I was just very excited and elated by it. And then also I started looking at advertising and TV commercials and print commercials. And I started to realize that much like in the 60s and the 70s, and Black magazines where you had an emerging Black middle class that was coming up that were buy products, and advertisers would use the Afro as a signifier to signify that, you know, this is for Black people or Blackness, or to encourage Black people, as a sign of the times. Very much today, if you start looking at a lot of ads that deal with pop culture that are geared towards either a Black market or you want to tap into the Black market, is that a lot of the models, whether they're male, female, little kids, have little teeny afros, big fluffy afros. They just have natural hair. So that's something that really intrigued me. And I've talked to a couple of people that worked in advertising. One of my former students that works with Spike Lee's agency, Debu Thomas. We got into a little conversation, not very long-winded, about the whole scenario of how advertisers use that way of defining Blackness or Black aesthetic. And some black people resent it, black women, because they're like, well, not all black women have natural hair.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that you need to be more representational of the market. And so I think it's a way of really tapping into what advertisers look at as being hip and part of black popular culture. So you identify what you think is this segmented market of your users and say, okay, we're going to dress them, or we're going to only use people that look this way. So it's no longer like always the weave and the flowing hair.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see the natural. And I don't see a lot of dreads in TV or print commercials, not to say that they don't exist. And I look at films, not too much braids, some.
Mm-hmm.
But that's more or less what I look at as a black aesthetic. I also look at music and fashion. I think music has a way of really pushing the black aesthetic in the vernacular and the language and the narrative that comes out of music, the syncopated beat.
Mm-hmm.
I also think of films. What's happening with that? I mean, I also sort of look at it from a standpoint of the ability to tell my story or our story is my responsibility, because who else is going to talk about the Afro but me or another black woman? And so I think it's very much like what a playwright might do. I could think of what filmmakers do. I could think of people that do documentaries like Thomas, Alan Harris, and Deborah Willis that have a documentary that's coming out on black photographers. It's their mission to talk about black photographers and to give us a little history of who were the black photographers and who are the black photographers now and who have transcended over time. So if they don't tell us, someone like Deborah Willis or Thomas Alan Harris, who else is going to tell our stories? So I think it's really very important for us to tell our stories. And I can think of Saki Mafandikwa, that wrote a book on African alphabets and decided to move back home after a long stint in New York City as a art director in books, moved back to Zimbabwe to start an art school. And in South Africa, and particularly in Zimbabwe, there were no design schools. So Saki opened up a design school, and he's had this school for 10 years now. And he'd be an amazing person for you to talk to about what he's done and what his school has done and what it's doing now. So I just sort of look at, you know, me talking about the Afro as part of my thesis, as part of my mission, and telling the black story.
Well, we'll have to talk after this about reaching out to Saki, because I think that would be a really good interview to talk about a lot of the work that he's done with typography. I saw a TED talk that he did where he spoke about African alphabets that was astonishing.
He's very good. He's an amazing speaker. One of my design crit alums, Amelie, who's working at the Vitro Museum in it's not Austria that it's in us. It'll come to me later. Sorry. She emailed me and asked me for an introduction to Saki, because she said, I see that you know him on LinkedIn, and I'm working on this project that has to do with African architecture and design. And I think that him and his students would be great to be a part of this exhibition project. And I connected the two of them, so I know that he's going to be doing something with the Vitra Museum within the next year or two. And so it would be good to find, you know, to talk to him about that. But he's just an amazing, amazing what he's done with his school.
Are you working on any personal projects now?
Yes, I am. I am developing some book proposals. One will focus on my thesis. Another one I'm developing with a colleague that's an architectural historian out of the University of Michigan. And we're hoping to put together a book that's a collection of essays by and about blacks or Africans or people from the Caribbean that work in placemaking, urban design, architecture. And we're just still formulating our ideas, and I've been collecting information from different people. So I've had a couple former DCRIT alums send me abstracts from their thesis to submit as part of our book proposal. I'd like to do a book based on my Afro-narrative talk. Actually call it The Afro Talks Back, because I think that the Afro speaks back to the viewers. I look at the Afro as sometimes being a protagonist. And then this past summer, I spent a month in Brazil, traveling throughout Brazil, more in the north than in the south, although I did spend some time in the south. And I did a lot of interviewing of visual artists, designers, and makers there. And I'd like to be able at some point to compile a book that really covers my research of what designers and makers and visual artists do in the northern part of Brazil. And maybe I might end up focusing more on the state of Bahia, because I often think that when people speak about design in Brazil or makers in Brazil, that they tend to leave out the northern part of Brazil, this in the state of Bahia in particular. And Brazil has very rich culture in the arts and design. And it's a country that could easily be divided into three or five countries. And most of the design that you'll see that comes out of Brazil tends to come from the southern part, like places like Sao Paulo and Rio, because those are the large metropolitan areas that are very much like being in a Chicago and LA or New York City. So that's where people really go to do their design. So I'm interested in finding people more in the northern part that do product design, furniture design, industrial design, and some fashion design. So hopefully I'll get a grant and I could go back and do more research. And I have an interest in making films. And so I started last year collaborating with a colleague, George Lockins, and we have put together a proposal where we will be shooting designers and makers and thinkers of color. We've shot two people so far, and we're hoping to do more. And we realize that probably as we move forward, that we'll have to do some crowdfunding. So whether it's an Indiegogo or Kickstarter campaign, that in order to really launch the project properly and to market and promote it and to build out a website where we could host all of our information. And that's some of the things that I have an interest in doing when it comes to collaborating. And I also like working with other creative entrepreneurs, like product designers or visual artists, and looking at how they could take their work and transform it into other areas and mediums, like whether it's tabletop design, stationery, or fashion, or surface patterns, textiles. So that's another area that I would love to explore and collaborate on with people. So I think that'll keep me pretty busy for the next century.
Yeah, I was going to say, what is it that inspires you to do all of this? But it seems like it's almost limitless.
Well, I just think that as a creative person, no one area can contain you. And I just have these interests, and I just feel that I like designing, and I like making, and I like doing things with my hands. And I feel that as you move through life, you start to shift your interests. And I think it's good to explore those interests, because a lot of times, as I said before, the skill set that you have in one area, some of those skills can transfer into other areas. And then, you know, you'll take a course here and there and you'll learn some skills that help you grow in an area that you have an interest in. Like, I've taken courses in tabletop design, not to say that I would go out and say, oh, yes, I'm a tabletop designer. But I have some basic fundamental understandings of tabletop design that would give me skills to say, okay, yes, I know how to do the specifications for plates or a place setting, taking an online course in textile design to learn how to do repeats and how to develop designs and how to apply them to a dress, a table, a wall. So, I think if you have those certain skills, you start to look at what else can I do with these skills? It's no different than if I go back and I look at the skills that I gained from design criticism. How else can I take those skills and actually use them in other areas? So for me to collaborate with George Larkins in developing the film series of Designers and Makers, that's something that I gained from my secret days. But then I could also go back and say, well, when I worked on staff and magazines, I art directed a lot of photo shoots. So I do know how to art direct people in front of a camera. And I know how to develop storyboards. And so you start to put together all those skills that you have. And then you go out and you talk to people that you know that may be doing exactly what you want to do. And you ask for help. If someone is willing to share some tidbits or facts or direct you towards where you need to go. And I think it's important to do that and ask for help from people, because people will either say yes or no. And a lot of times people are really, really generous and more than willing to help you.
Mm-hmm.
I remember for one of my classes, I had to put together a proposal. It was for my applied thesis. And I had come up with the idea. I said, well, I'd like to do a film on the Afro, and it would be like a 45-minute documentary. And I emailed a friend and asked him, would you give me some pointers on, how I could actually put together a proposal? And he said, sure. And I called him up, and we talked, and it was amazing help. And, he told me what people are doing now, what he does. He said every proposal is different. He said, but, these are the key points that you need in the proposal. And if you're going to raise funds and you're going to do crowdsourcing, he said it's a lot of work. He said, but, this is what you need to do to mount a successful campaign. And so, mm-hmm. You ask for help.
Yeah, I think asking in collaboration is so important, because I feel, at least for a lot of, I think, up-and-coming designers, maybe they feel they have to sort of walk the road alone, as opposed to really asking for help, whether it's with mentorship or even just like you're mentioning, just asking a few questions to kind of get the ball rolling.
Yeah, the thing is that even though I had a very successful design firm for 12 years, when I moved back to New York City from Chicago, I had a studio space in Dumbo, way before Dumbo was really poopoo shishi. And, before that, I always thought that, I would love to have a business. I'd love to have a business. And I come from a family of entrepreneurs. I grew up where on both sides of my family, my grandfathers had business, my dad and his brothers ran a business. But I also realized something early on in my career is that I needed to learn from other people and learn the basics of my business. So if I was going to be in graphic design, I needed to know about graphic design. I needed to know about the business of graphic design. I needed to know how people ran a business. And so I took workshops through the American Women Economic Development Association. They had a series of, I think it was 12 or 15 weeks. You'd come in and they would do they would cover different topics each week, and there would be a different speaker that would talk about everything from choosing a name, how to set up accounts, how to deal with banking, how to deal with accounting, staffing, and then you could go in for counseling. And then, I learned things through the AIGA, through networking, and I learned from working with other people in their studio spaces. Because you have to rent a space. And that's very different than you working for a company. And, so the things that you have to learn, you have to go out and ask. So I often feel that in things that I have an interest in and in collaboration, it's a little similar. It's a similar way, because I'm not always knowing how to do something 100%. So I'm finding someone that has those skill sets that's a good mesh for me, and that they have the same interests and the same passion that I have. And so you can come together and you can work on something. And I think it's important. And so asking people and learning that particular area is real important, whether you're just starting out or you're seasoned. And I think it's even more important for people who are just starting out, because a lot of times I have students that say, oh, yeah, you know, I want to go. I don't want to work for anybody. I want to go start. I want to work for myself. And I was like, well, you know, you might want to work for someone just so that you can get a sense of the business, how to communicate with clients, even how to get clients and how to maintain clients, because you could be the best of what you are in your area, but people have to know that you exist, and how are they going to come to you and find you and everything like that. So it's a long process.
All right. So just to wrap things up, can you tell us where our audience can find you online?
I have a blog. I blog called Cultural Boundaries, and I will send you a link. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. And that's where you can find me.
Michelle Washington, thank you again so much for this interview. For the people that are listening, this is the third time that we've had to do this. And I just really, really appreciate it. This has been a wonderful talk. Just so much, just great information. Thank you again so much. I appreciate it.
Well, I thank you for inviting me and asking me to participate. And I should thank Steve Jones, Andrew Bass, and Maurice Woods for their kind words in recommending me.
And that's it for this week. Big thanks to Michelle Washington, and thanks to you for listening. Don't forget to take our survey at revisionpath.com/survey and subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher. Revision Path is a 318 Media project. If you like what we're doing with these podcasts, you can help sponsor the show. Contact information will be included in the show notes. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.